don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, Crypto Economy crew? Welcome back to the show. So, we will be continuing with part two of the iterative capital thesis. This one is titled Historical Background on the Phenomenon. And I've got a couple things that I should be announcing soon on the website, but most of it I'm still working on. I like to see how much I got a lot of stuff to do on the house this weekend, but hopefully I'll be able to work on it as well, and I'll have something to announce maybe earlier next week. But nothing new on that front yet. Just to check out all the other stuff, I'm still trying to get it organized and everything. Don't forget to check out cryptoeconomy.life, where all of that stuff will be published. Without further ado, let's just go ahead and jump right in. Again, this is section two, so if you did not listen to yesterday's episode, we are going to be jumping right into the middle of a huge and amazing piece that should extend out to the end of next week. So go back and listen to yesterday's episode, and then come back to this one. But for everybody who is caught up, let's go ahead and jump into section two, Historical Background on the Phenomenon. Using context to understand why hackers set out to build digital currency systems. Quote, "Corporations have neither bodies to be punished nor souls to be condemned. They therefore do as they like." End quote. Edward Thurlow, Lord Chancellor of Great Britain, 1778 to 1792. Satoshi Nakamoto was the first participant in his own network, and left a message within the very first block of data produced by Bitcoin. The message within this so-called Genesis block read, Figure 1, the message left by Satoshi Nakamoto in Bitcoin's Genesis block. Quote, "The Times, 3rd January 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks." End quote. The original headline appears in the British paper The Times. See figure below. The inclusion of this note is a source of widespread confusion. Given what we know about Nakamoto's motivation to create a free economic space outside the purview of institutional oversight, it would seem that this message makes light of the sympathetic relationship between politicians and central bankers. Many people use this allusion to infer that Bitcoin was purpose-built as some kind of disruptor or destroyer of central banks. Taken this way, the headline would seem to be a statement of superiority or self-righteousness. We suggest that this is a mischaracterization. If Bitcoin does evolve into a large-scale alternative currency system, then Nakamoto's use of the Times headline will strike historians as timely, but it is more than just a political statement. Figure 2, the headline reproduced in the Genesis block. In fact, putting a headline in the Genesis block has a second, more practical purpose. It serves as a timestamp. By reproducing the text from that day's paper, Nakamoto proved that the first block of data produced by the network was indeed made that day and not prior. Nakamoto knew Bitcoin was a new kind of network that prospective participants would scarcely believe was real. At the outset, it would be important to send a signal of integrity to people who might join. Getting volunteers to value the project was top priority, indeed a far higher priority than mocking central bankers. For investors outside the technology industry, understanding this volunteer-based way of working is critical to understanding why Bitcoin operates the way it does, and why it is an improvement on conventional methods of human collaboration. To get to these points, we will first explore the origins of the war that Satoshi is engaged in and how the invention of Bitcoin is meant to change the tide. The old friction between technologists and management. For the last 50 years, corporate technology companies are increasingly at odds with the engineers that build their critical systems. Recent headlines tell the story. At Microsoft, Amazon, and Salesforce, employees protested contracts with Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. At Google, employees protested the company's Project Maven AI contracts for the Department of Defense, which promised to increase the accuracy of drone strikes. It bowed out from Project Maven, but has said it will continue to work with the U.S. military in other projects. Google's announcement that it would agree to censor search results inside China drew 1,400 workers to protest. Microsoft is facing a lawsuit by two employees who may have suffered PTSD after seeing child pornography as part of content moderation rules. YouTube employees describe their jobs as a, quote, daily hell of ethics debate. Facebook has experienced protests for the gentrification wrought by its tens of thousands of employees, as well as more recent protests for its, quote, intolerant political culture. Other abuses of technological systems include the personal data leak at Equifax and the abuse of account creation privileges within the Wells Fargo Bank computer system, where accounts were opened and cards issued in some cases with forged signatures in service of sales goals. The worst example of abusive corporate software systems might be the maker of the automated sentencing software employed by some court systems called Compass, which has been shown to recommend prison terms based on the convict's race. Tensions between software developers and their employers have spilled out of Silicon Valley and into mainstream news. Quote, "This engineer's lament is a microcosm of a larger trend sweeping across the peninsula of San Francisco," reported Vanity Fair in August of 2018. Quote, "In Silicon Valley's halcyon days, employees didn't have any qualms about the ethics of the companies they were joining, since many honestly believed that they were going to advance a corporation that was going to, yes, change the world. The people who helped transform the Bay Area into the greatest wealth generation machine in human history, and themselves into millionaires and billionaires in the process, are now turning their backs on the likes of hegemonic corporations who, in their own depictions, moved fast and broke things without an end in sight." End quote. The article quotes an anonymous Uber executive who fears that ethical issues will motivate engineers to leave en masse. Quote, "If we can't hire any good engineers, we're fucked." End quote. This is a liminal moment in business where the good engineers suddenly have leverage over the wealthy and elite management of some of the largest corporations in the history of the world. This development did not arrive overnight. It has its origins in a tension that originated decades ago. Next, we will look at how the balance of power shifted and how Bitcoin tips the scale further for the good engineers. To appreciate how the software engineers got their leverage, we must begin in the early 20th century and learn how managers and engineers got to be at odds in the first place. The emergence of the corporate institution, 1900 to 1929. The study of human behavior in a business context has a rich tradition. Perhaps the first person to take a meaningful step forward in this discipline was Frederick Winslow Taylor. Quote, "Taylorism, his conception of management science, was all about rational planning, reducing waste, analyzing data, and standardizing best practices. Business owners used these techniques to drive workers uncommonly hard. Andrew Carnegie obsessed over worker productivity, becoming so frustrated with the Homestead Strike of 1892 that he hired a private police force to have picketing workers shot. Thorstein Veblen was a Norwegian-American economist who published his seminal study of Practitioners of Management Science in 1904. He created a series of insights about the nature of institutions as distinct from the technologies used by them. This distinction is a good starting point for understanding the problems that arise for people who create new technologies within institutions. An important aspect of Veblen's concept of, quote, institution is that they are by nature non-dynamic. They resist changes that don't benefit the top people in the hierarchical structure. Hierarchy persists through what Veblen called, quote, ceremonial aspects, traditional privileges that serve to elevate the decision makers. It is new technological tools and processes which make the institution profitable, but so-called spurious tools may also be produced because they have ceremonial aspects that make management look or feel good. After the Great Depression, the historian and sociologist Lewis Mumford would develop the idea that technology had a dual nature. Polytechnic developments involved complex frameworks which combined technologies to solve real human problems. Monotechnic developments were technology for its own sake. Monotechnics oppress human beings, Mumford argued, citing the automobile as one such development that crowded out pedestrians and bicyclists from roads and led to a massive annual death toll on American highways. The institutions of the day, corporations and governments, Mumford called mega machines. Mega machines, he said, are comprised of many human beings, each with a specialized role in a larger bureaucracy. He called these individuals, quote, servo units. Mumford argued that for these people, the specialized nature of the work weakened psychological barriers against questionable commands from leadership, because each individual was responsible for only one small aspect of the machine's overall goal. At the top of a mega machine sat a corporate scion, dictator or commander, to whom godlike attributes were attributed. He cited the lionization of Egyptian pharaohs and Soviet dictators as examples. Ceremonial, spurious, monotechnic developments could lead to extremely deadly mega machines, said Mumford, as in the case of the Nazi war machine. This phenomenon owed itself to the abstraction of the work into subtasks and specialties, such as assembly line work and radio communications. This abstraction allowed the servo units to work on extreme or heinous projects without ethical involvement, because they only comprised one small step of the larger process. Mumford called servo units in such a machine Eichmanns, after the Nazi official who coordinated the logistics of the German concentration camps in World War II. In the early 20th century, the new and trendy field of, quote, management science was greatly influenced by Fordism, the practices of Henry Ford. Fordist mass production was characterized by a rigorous and somewhat dreary focus on efficiency, specialization, mass production, reasonable hours, and living wages. But when the Great Depression came, owners like Ford laid off workers by the tens of thousands. Wages dropped, but the punishing nature of the work remained. Ford Motor Company laid off 60,000 workers in August of 1931. Less than a year later, security guards opened fire on several thousand picketing workers, killing four and wounding 25. Henry Ford placed machine gun nests around his home and equipped guards with tear gas and surplus ammunition. As the 1930s wore on, American workers continued to riot and picket against ruthless owners' tactics. Modern management emerges to protect workers. 1930 to 1940. After the Depression, a class of professionals emerged to take major business decisions away from the business owners. Industry would be run by professional managers who would execute plans in the best interest of both the owners and the employees. They derived their positions and power from their competence, not their percentage of ownership. the greedy shareholders could be held at bay in this new structure. John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economics professor, studied this phenomenon at the time. Quote, "The power passed from one man, there were no women, or not many, into a structure, a bureaucracy, and that is the modern corporation. It is a great bureaucratic apparatus to which I gave the name technostructure. The shareholder is an irrelevant fixture. They give the symbolism of ownership and of capitalism, but when it comes to the actual operation of the corporation, they exercise very little power." End quote. This, quote, "bureaucratic apparatus" of the technostructure consisted of upper-tier managers, analysts, executives, planners, administrators, operational back-office staff, sales and marketing, controllers, accountants, and other non-technical white-collar staff. In 1937, Nobel Prize winner Ronald Coase built on the ideas of the managerial scientists to theorize why these massive firms were emerging and why they accumulated so many workers. He theorized this behavior was rational and was aimed at reducing transaction costs. He wrote, quote, "The source of the gain from having a firm is that the operation of a market costs something, and that, by forming an organization and allowing the allocation of resources to be determined administratively, these costs are saved." End quote. In other words, in the hiring of skilled labor, it is cheaper to retain a salaried worker who returns each day than to go out each day and select a new temporary candidate from a pool of contractors in a market. He continued, quote, "Firms will emerge to organize what would otherwise be market transactions whenever their costs were less than carrying out the transactions through the market." End quote. The corporation was the most efficient way to mass produce and distribute consumer goods. It tied together supply chains, production facilities, and distribution networks under centralized management. This increased efficiencies and productivity, lowered marginal costs, and made goods and services cheaper for consumers. Managerial bureaucracy becomes abusive to the engineer class, 1940 to 1970. As of 1932, the majority of these corporations were, in all practicality, no longer controlled by their majority shareholders, classified by economists as management-controlled. The management fad, which became known as separation of ownership and control, spread throughout the major public corporations. The moral hazards of management-controlled companies became increasingly obvious as the 1930s wore on. Management-controlled companies were run by executives, which, despite not owning many shares, eventually achieved, quote, "self-perpetuating positions of control of policies," because they are able to manipulate the boards of directors through proxies and majority shareholder votes. These machinations sometimes created high levels of conflict. In the early 1940s, the idea emerged that this structural divide in the corporate world was being mimicked in the social and political worlds, with a distinct elite management class emerging in society. Institutional economists drew a distinction between the management class and the class of, quote, "technical operators," the people doing the work, in many cases engineers and technicians. The managerial elite consisted of the analysts or specialists who acted as the bureaucratic planners, budgetary allocators, and non-technical managers. A strange power dynamic emerged between the analysts and the technical staff in the computer companies, which had emerged between 1957 and 1969. This dynamic was studied by industrial economists in both the UK and US. They found that the analysts jockeyed for power, creating conflict. They won favor and influence over the company by expanding their divisions, creating opportunities to hire more direct reports or to win a new promotion, a tactic known as, quote, "empire building." The overall effect on the organization was misallocation of resources and incredible pressure to grow. Sales and development cycles were persistently rushed. The computer analyst's slogan became, quote, "If it works, it's obsolescent." the analyst had a, quote, vested interest in change. This dynamic had created dysfunction. Managers used a variety of social tactics to enforce their will and agenda in spite of technical realities, reflecting Veblen's observation about ceremonial institutions 75 years before. Documented tactics included organizational inertia. New and threatening ideas are blocked with advice, idea killers, including the boss won't like it, it's not policy, I don't have the authority, it's never been tried, we've always done it that way, and why change something that works? Budget games. Foot in the door, where a new program is sold in modestly, concealing its real magnitude. Hidden ball, where a politically unattractive program is concealed within an attractive one. Divide and conquer, where approval of a budget request is sought from more than one supervisor. It's free, where it is argued that someone else will pay for the project, so the organization might as well approve it. Razzle dazzle, where a request is supported with voluminous data, but arranged in such a way that their significance is not clear. Delayed buck, where deliverables are submitted late, with the argument that the budget guidelines require too much detailed calculation, and many others. These tales from the 1960s anticipate the emergence of the popular cartoon Dilbert in the 1990s, which skewered absurd managerial behavior. Its author, Scott Adams, had worked as a computer programmer and manager at Pacific Bell from 1986 to 1995. Figure 3. Our sales for the quarter are zero. Because I might have mentioned on CNBC that we have a better, cheaper model coming soon. So, great job on the new product, and I need to fire half of you so it looks as if I do things. What is your home address? Dilbert captured the frustration of software engineers in a corporate setting. Credit Scott Adams. Group identity develops amongst professional technologists, 1980 to 2000. The dictatorial behavior of the management class belied the true balance of power in technical organizations. In the 1980s, the entire weight of many industrial giants rested upon its technologists, but their role put them in a strange position, at odds with the rest of their organization. Placed at the margins of the organization, closest to the work, they were removed from the C-suite and its power plays. Not working with executives directly, the technologists identified far less with the heads of the company than the managers, who directly reported to C-suite. The technologists' work was enjoyable to them, but opaque to the rest of the organization. A power dynamic emerged between the technical operators and the rest of the company. Their projects were difficult to supervise and proceeded whimsically in ways that reflected the developers' own interests. Their power to work this way originated in their critical skills. These skills act as a wedge within organizations, earning technical operators considerable freedom of direction. The efficacy of this wedge increased when the technical operator provided a skill which was in great demand, affording them job mobility. In this instance, their dependence on the organization was reduced. Company ideology was typically not a strong force among technologists. In comparison to, quote, professional ideology, or the belief in the profession and its norms, the elite technologists were becoming outsiders within their own companies. Instead of loyalty to company or CEO, technologists developed, as a professional goal, loyalty to the end user or client. A company's technologists were focused on the needs of the existing customer, while the analysts and managers, whose work did not deal directly with the end user, supported more abstract goals like efficiency and growth. The hacker movement emerges. The hacker movement had originated amongst software makers at MIT in the 1960s. Perhaps seen as an antidote to the managerial dysfunction inside the older corporate tech companies, the hacker movement's focus on practical, useful, and excellent software spread rapidly across the country in the 1980s and 1990s. MIT software activist Richard Stallman described hackers as playful but diligent problem solvers who prided themselves on their individual ingenuity. Quote, "What they had in common was mainly love of excellence in programming. They wanted to make their programs that they used be as good as they could. They also wanted to make them do neat things. They wanted to be able to do something in a more exciting way than anyone believed possible and show, look how wonderful this is. I bet you didn't believe this could be done. Hackers don't want to work. They want to play." End quote. At a conference in 1984, a hacker who had gone to work at Apple to build the Macintosh described hacker status as follows. Quote, "Hackers can do almost anything and be a hacker. It's not necessarily high tech. I think it has to do with craftsmanship and caring about what you're doing." End quote. The hacker movement is not unlike the Luddite movement of the early 19th century, in which cotton and wool artisans in central England rose up to destroy the Jacquard loom, which threatened to automate them. Unlike the Luddites, who proposed no better alternative to the loom, hackers came up with another approach to making software, which has since produced superior products to their commercial alternatives. By using the internet to collaborate, groups of volunteer developers have come to produce software that rivaled the products of nation-states and corporations. New Jersey style emerges. The quote, "New Jersey style of hacking was originated by Unix engineers at AT&T in suburban New Jersey. AT&T had lost an antitrust settlement in 1956, which precluded it from entering the computer business. Thus, it was free to circulate the computer operating system it had built, called Unix, to other private companies and research institutions throughout the 1970s. The source code was included, and these institutions regularly modified it to run on their particular mini-computers. Hacking Unix became a cultural phenomenon within R&D departments around the United States. Unix was rewritten for personal computers by several groups of developers. Linus Torvalds created his own version, Linux, and distributed it for free, just as AT&T had done with Unix. As we will show, Linux has become enormously successful. The approach taken by Torvalds and other Unix hackers uses playfulness as an energizing force to build useful, if difficult, free software projects. The Finnish computer scientist and philosopher Pekka Hämanen wrote at the time, quote, "To do the Unix philosophy right, you have to be loyal to excellence. You have to believe that software is a craft worth all the intelligence and passion you can muster." End quote. R&D developers realize worse is better. Out of New Jersey style, software engineers developed a set of ad hoc design principles that went against the perfectionism of institutionalized software. The old way said to build, quote, the right thing, completely and consistently. But this approach wasted time and often led to an over-reliance on theory. Written during the early 1980s by Richard Gabriel and published by Netscape Navigator engineer Jamie Zawinski, in 1991, the, quote, "worse is better" philosophy boiled down the best of New Jersey style and hacker wisdom. It was seen as a practical improvement on the MIT-Stanford hacker approach. Much like the MIT ethic, worse is better values excellence in software. But unlike MIT-Stanford, the worse is better approach redefines excellence in a way that prioritizes positive real-world user feedback and adoption over theoretical ideals. Worse is better holds that, so long as the design of the initial program is a clear expression of a solution to a specific problem, then it will take less time and effort to implement a, quote, good version initially and adapt it to new situations than it would be to build a perfect version straight away. Releasing software to users early and improving a program often is sometimes called iterative development. Iterative development allows software to spread rapidly and benefit from real-world reactions from users. Programs released early and improved often become successful long before, quote, better versions written in the MIT approach have a chance to be deployed. With two seminal papers in 1981 and 1982, the concept of first mover advantage emerged in the software industry around the same time that Gabriel was formalizing his ideas about why, in networked software, worse is better. The logic of worse is better prioritizes viral growth over fit and finish. Once a good program has spread widely, there will be many users with an interest in improving its functionality and making it excellent. An abbreviated version of the principles of worse is better are below. They admonish developers to avoid doing what is conceptually pleasing, the right thing, in favor of doing whatever results in practical, functional programs. Emphasis added. Simplicity. This is the most important consideration in a design. Correctness. The design must be a correct solution to the problem. It is slightly better to be simple than correct. Consistency. Consistency can be sacrificed for simplicity in some cases, but it is better to drop those parts of the design that deal with less common circumstances than to introduce either implementational complexity or inconsistency. Completeness. The design must cover as many important situations as is practical. Completeness can be sacrificed in favor of any other quality. In fact, completeness must be sacrificed whenever implementation simplicity is jeopardized. These conceptual breakthroughs must have been exciting to the technologists of the early 1980s, but the excitement would soon be disrupted by rapid changes in business. The shareholders use hostile takeovers to clamp down on everyone. The hacker-centric environment inside universities and large research corporations collapsed, and researchers at places like the MIT AI Lab were poached away by venture capitalists to continue their work, but in a proprietary setting. The hostile takeover trend had begun a decade before in the UK, where clever investors began noticing that many of the family-run businesses were no longer majority-owned by their founding families. Financiers like Jim Slater and James Goldsmith quietly bought up shares in these companies, eventually wresting enough control to break up and sell off units of the company. This became known as asset stripping, and we will return to this topic in Section 7 of this essay. In the 1980s, American bankers hit upon a way of finance takeovers at massive scale by floating so-called junk bonds, then busting up the target company and reaping massive rewards from the sale of the parts. In this way, managerial capitalism eventually lost its hold over business and became a servant of the capital markets. Activist investors came to represent shareholder interests and took action to fire and hire C-suite executives who would maximize share price. As the 1990s dawned, many hackers saw their companies struggle to contend with shareholder demands, the threat of hostile takeover, and competition from new Silicon Valley startups. As tech companies moved faster, they developed ways for management to enforce policy and resource allocation. Microsoft and others adopted a rigorous, quote, stack ranking system, whereby employees were assigned numerical scores on regular intervals using a performance review process in order to determine promotions, bonuses, and team assignments. A certain percentage of bottom-ranking employees were fired. This system is still used by tech companies today, but Microsoft abandoned it in 2013. Google adopted stack ranking recently to establish eligibility for promotions, but does not fire poorly scoring employees. Stack ranking systems are widely hated for the uncomfortable power dynamics they create. Today, investors demand from their companies precise predictions about each quarter's profitability, and less concern is paid to capital investment. Tesla is one notable technology company which has articulated the way quarterly guidance and short-termism diminish a high-tech company's long-term prospects. According to the Business Roundtable, a corporate alliance chaired by Chase Bank CEO Jamie Dimon, quarterly guidance has become, quote, detrimental to long-term strategic investments. Summary. In this section, we have looked at the ways that 1940s-era management make life unpleasant for high-tech workers, and how these patterns persisted into the 1990s, disenfranchising technical workers. We've shown a strong guild identity developed, which transcends loyalty to the employer. We've associated this identity with the growth of hacker culture and its principles. Next, we will explore how antipathy towards the management class grew into a wider suspicion of all institutional oversight, and how their struggle to get out from under such oversight acquired a moral dimension. We will examine why hackers looked to cyberspace and cryptography for sanctuary, with a determination to build new tools outside the purview of the management class. We will consider the surprising success of free software tools produced by hackers, and consider the ways that corporate employers have alternately fought and also tried to emulate hacker methodology. Finally, we will encounter Bitcoin as the realization of many hacker ambitions in a single network. All right, and that will conclude section two of the iterative capital thesis on the cryptocurrency phenomenon. So this one, again, we're going to dive so much deeper into this, and there's tons of stuff coming about the hacker culture and the origins of this movement. One book, actually, that I have read on this topic, I've read a number of books on this topic, because this is something that has always fascinated me, and I really am intrigued by some of the points made in this section in particular about how it was there are always hierarchies in any institutions, and it's a constant struggle between hierarchies of a perceived authority, like authority within the institution, versus hierarchies of competence, and there's this constant struggle with agreements within the company and with the owners and employees to figure out where those hierarchies are going wrong, because where those hierarchies are not right, they cause struggles, they cause pressures within the participants of the quote-unquote machine. And really, that's exactly what a business is a machine built with contracts connecting people and their roles within that machine. So it's just a really interesting context to hit it just what are those power struggles? What's the difference between a manager and an employee? And particularly when it comes to the ever-changing environment where there are less and less people needed to do the entire stack of product in the software world, in the world of cyberspace. It's becoming less important to need this overarching managerial class or this area of people to get stuff done, because the problem and the solution are all in one, it's in one thing. There's the separation between the problem solver and the client is getting smaller and smaller and smaller as technology progresses. Because never before, think about it, in the world of software, you have prototyping, you have all the tools necessary, you have everything from the general idea that you've come up with to the actual production in your hands. And when you think about an institution or a corporation, that was originally to get the capital together into a machine that bridged the gap between the idea itself and the finished product. But in the software world, in cyberspace, all of that is there, and it's free to use. The whole stack is there. And we're starting to see that become a reality with technology in the real world. Like something like 3D printing is another great example of taking out middlemen in the stack of managing idea to product. I mean, think about how insane it is to think, oh, I can just come up with an idea for some little tinkering tool or gadget or gear or something, design it in my computer on free software, and then print it on my 3D printer in plastic to test it out and see if it works. Like technology is just destroying gaps between solutions to problems and the problem themselves in a major, major way. And it's moving so fast that you see things like this happen where institutions, governments, corporations are not moving fast enough. They can't change quickly enough to account for the fact that there are whole sections of that company that may have become redundant with competent technologists who are kept up with, who know what's happening. And the fact that this open source movement has been birthed from the necessity of solving these problems quicker and getting them to market almost immediately by solving just that. I love the hacker ethic or the, let me find it here. The worse is better philosophy, the simplicity, correctness, consistency, and completeness, where completeness should be sacrificed in the place of simplicity. The idea is to get a decent program out that solves the core of the problem quickly so that users can respond to it, people can engage, and a community can be built around it to figure out where it needs to be pushed. Like, you know, rather than thinking that I've got the theory from start to finish, is get it out there and let people say, you know, this is what I hope it would be, or maybe this is a problem that it could solve maybe a little bit better if pushed in this direction. Here's the major problem with it. There's just so much. It's such a fascinating idea of just this open community of building software to solve problems that organizes itself. It's just a fascinating thing. And I always love discussion like this and research on where did these pressures come from? What causes something like that to emerge? And what is it about the technology itself that manages to organize these things? That's what my fascination with money is in general, because money is a technology that forces us to cooperate, to share the altruistic benefits, to trade altruism between people who could hate each other in any other context. Like that's why I've always been fascinated by the idea of money as the foundation for society. There is no way to scale the trade of altruism without an independent medium that's unbiased to any of our subjective values. And this is very similar to that. It's a means of software. These open software systems have this degree of coordination somehow, and it's just such a fun concept to me. It's such an interesting thing to dig into. So I don't want to go on forever. I could just blab about this for 6 hours. So we will go ahead and close this one here. Happy Friday, everybody. I think this one's probably going to be out a little bit late because this was a really long piece, and I think section 3 is pretty long too, if I'm not mistaken. So get prepared. We're going to be diving into this one on Monday as well. And there is a ton of stuff to come. It's just a huge piece to tackle, and it's going to be fun. So stick with me. We got parts 3 through 7 coming next week. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Check out iterative.capital online. They've got research and the newsletter coming out constantly, always putting their input out on new developments and things going on in the ecosystem. A great resource, obviously, as we're digging through this entire piece. So don't forget to follow both them and me on Twitter. You can find Iterative Cap, that's their tag, at Iterative Cap on Twitter. And you can find me at The Crypto Economy. You can find me on cryptoeconomy.life. There'll be links to my Twitter and everything up there. So if you just go to cryptoeconomy.life, that'll get you the whole list of stuff. If you want to donate to the show to help me keep this stuff coming, that's a huge, huge help. Thank you so much for everyone who has. Outside of that, share it with your friends. Spread this out to anybody who wants to hear about this awesome history and technology, because that's what we do here. We read anything and everything on this topic to make it available in audio to the people who don't have the time to sit down and do this. So share the Crypto Economy podcast with everybody you know in the Bitcoin space, and I will be here talking to you again on Monday with another episode of the Crypto Economy podcast. All right, guys, until next time, have a wonderful weekend and take it easy.